Thank you for tuning in to the Pivot Podcast. Today, Jeff and I are pleased to welcome one of our very own. I'm talking about RBC's Michael Polak. Greetings and welcome to you, sir.
Chego, greetings. Thanks for having me.
Michael is a commercial account manager within business financial services at RBC with a specialization in media and entertainment financing. If that role doesn't keep him busy enough, and I know it does, Michael is also our national co-chair of the Royal Eagles Employee Resource Group, as well as co-chair of the Indigenous Center of Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Michael is Mohawk Bear Clan, and he spent his youth growing up near Hamilton, Ontario. Michael, I'm going to ask you the same question that I ask all of our guests to start things off here, and that is, tell us about yourself. Tell us a little bit more about your personal and professional background, what brought you to RBC, and why you chose to come to the beautiful East Coast of Canada. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. And, you know, usually I would start introducing myself in Mohawk and my clan and stuff, but you so graciously took care of that for me. Who I am? Interesting. Without going too far back in time, I did want to address my identity and also kind of share the context and perspective from which I'm going to speak today, which is really most of the exposure to culture that I've received is directly related to my connection to my family. So I'm Polish in Mohawk. I'm Polish on my father's side, Mohawk on my mother's side. And I've been very connected to both my families and grandfathers and cultures. And that's given me a unique perspective to literally walk from one cultural family gathering and all the tradition and ceremony that's involved in that the next day and literally walk into a completely different scenario and situation. Just as an example, on my Polish side, obviously vodka is a big part of our culture and our celebrations. And on my Mohawk side, alcohol is not really involved in any of the gatherings. I also think it's really interesting So I'll be speaking from more of a Haudenosaunee perspective and that kind of what's referred to here in Mi'kma'ki, actually, which I've learned, which is two-eyed seeing. Elder Albert Marshall came up with this concept, or is a thought leader around the concept of two-eyed seeing. And that's really just the ability to see things from two different perspectives and two different worlds and try to blend those perspectives to create unique solutions or unique ways forward, bringing people together, finding the best elements and the best ideas from two different worlds. But you guys are wealth people, and we're in the bank. And I think, Marcel, when we first met and we were walking around town, and I first told you that I was Mohawk, I shared a little bit about this. But I think it's really important because it's a microcosm of a macro perspective around economic reconciliation. And it's something that I was able to observe throughout my life on both sides of my family. And there's some unique things there. So I'll just take my grandfathers, for example. So my Polish grandfather and my Mohawk grandfather. And my Polish grandfather was a prisoner of war. He made his way to Canada, started a life here. He was a carpenter, so he had a skilled trade, and he built houses. And over his life, he built several houses on the street that my parents grew up on and that my grandparents actually passed away on that street in Hamilton, Ontario. And over time, they sold all those houses, and he was on the board for the local Polish credit union, and he was an active participant in the economy. And he was enabled and allowed, as a result of Canadian laws and being an immigrant, but he was allowed to own things. He was allowed to own assets and generate wealth and then transfer that wealth down onto the next generation of our family. And I'm really just speaking to that one generational window. So my grandfather to my parents and then grandchildren. My Mohawk grandfather was an iron worker, which is a very, at the time, like very typical trait for Mohawk men. And he was born in 1918. And so he was also a tradesman and tradesperson, and he built a lot of the towers in New York. So he moved from Tayendinega, which is up near Bay of Quinte, Tayendinega Mohawk territory, and he migrated down to Niagara Falls, New York. He got situated and set up with a little cabin on Six Nations of the Grand River, or we say Oswegan, the land where the river parts. And so he had his little camper on the reserve in Six Nations, and he was living in Buffalo, and he was doing ironwork, some of the skyscrapers in New York. Because of the Indian Act, he was not allowed to own assets. So similar trade, hardworking person, you know, similar situation in a lot of ways to my Polish grandfather. The only difference was, as a result of being indigenous, because he was Mohawk, he was not allowed to own anything. So when he passed away, he had $1,000 in his bank account, and no wealth was passed on to anyone in the family. And we had 11, he had 11 kids, my mom included, in that. And so when I look at my generation, so all my cousins on both sides, I'm just an example of what the transfer of wealth does and how that enables a platform for future generations to succeed. Every single one of my cousins on my Polish side of the family, they all own homes. They all have university, post-secondary education. They're all married. They all have families. They all have children. And, you know, at a glance, one would say on paper, they're living successful, healthy lives. On the Mohawk side of my family, I'm the only one with a post-secondary education. No one owns any homes. No one owns any assets. And over the last 4 years, two of my cousins suffered from addiction and substance abuse, and they overdosed and passed away. And so the parallel and the contrast between those two worlds that I've seen in my life growing up, between just something as simple as being able to own assets and generate wealth and transfer wealth, and the result of Indian Act economics and the result of the situation in Canada created a generation of, I would say, trauma, and also created this amplification of like poverty as a sickness. And only now we're coming out of this as a family. And I would be probably one of the young ones in the family that's leading that way out of that and trying to show an example of what can be done with some of the opportunities that have now been presented as a result of efforts towards reconciliation.
That's quite a profound thought and experience you must have had just to when you were describing your Polish grandfather and the opportunities that you know, were afforded to him in that time when you compare it to your indigenous grandfather who had none of that in terms of his ability to own assets. And when you think about reconciliation, at least from an economic sense, reconciliation to me is a big word. It's like there's so many elements to it. And you highlighted a number of them so eloquently, one of them being economic and the inequality, I would say, that comes with that. Your lived experience as an indigenous person growing up in Canada is unique. And what does that reconciliation mean to you now? And as I said in my intro, you've taken a leadership role inside and outside of RBC when it comes to this issue. And what compels you to move forward in a leadership role? Clearly you have a lived experience. You don't need to be on this podcast. You don't need to go out and fly that flag, but you do it. Why is that?
So leadership, the word for leadership in Mohawk is Odioneso, and that means people of the nice. And that means those who choose to serve the community. So leadership is being a leader, or the respect that's garnered from leadership is a direct result of the amount of service that you give to a community. It's not quantified by a hierarchy or a title or a salary or, you know, quest for power. It comes as a direct result of how many people you can impact by offering gifts that you have to others. And I found that in my life, I've learned that, you know, this gift of two-eyed seeing has been something that people have found valuable. I also have this gift of sharing or storytelling or the ability to articulate my ideas in a way that help others come to an understanding or arrive at the truth, something like this. So as I continue to speak and find my voice, I found that it's resonated with others and it's helped move things forward in the areas and the spaces that I've been occupying. And that just is a positive reinforcing feedback loop of sharing, receiving good feedback, seeing positive results, seeing a positive impact on people, seeing it as that's a gift and a duty for me to share and serve others with that gift. And that's what's led me. I didn't seek out the Royal Eagles or any of the other responsibilities I have outside RBC on advisory councils or boards. I didn't even seek out this my actual job at RBC, media and entertainment. I think these are things, the work found me and the service found me. The only thing that I did was act accordingly, like behave how I was taught to behave and do that consistently. And then others found their way to me, and then that created opportunities for me to do more of it. So that's that. As far as reconciliation goes and my view on it, such a big word to try to unpack. And this month it gets done a lot. Reconciliation, to me, all that means is that other people are paying attention to the things that we've been trying to do for a long time. Like the work that the real, in the weeds, the work that's being done towards reconciliation, there's been a lot of us that have been doing this for a long time. And in fact, I would say probably viewed as like in a polarizing way up until a few years ago. And now, again, in that consistency, finding that people now want to join in on that. And I think putting a word to it or trying to conceptualize it helps people grab onto something. But for many of us, this is just a way of life. It's something we've always been doing, we're always going to do. And you call it whatever you want, the work will still get done. So it's important, and I value the fact that we have strong, active allies that are in the pursuit of equity and making things right and reconciliation and reconciling our ways of existing together. That's always been the intention. If you look at every peace and friendship treaty, every agreement, everything has always been in the spirit of sharing unity, harmony, peace, friendship, and reconciling things, reconciling our differences so that we can have a great life together. I'm going to go period there because I don't know what else I would add to that.
That's okay. I'm wondering, Michael, if we could take, so reconciliation is a big word to unpack. I agree. But you mentioned that, you know, you want other people paying attention. So I wonder if we could just spend some time and maybe I should put a bit of color on this. Like as a Canadian, you know, turning on the news, you see all kinds of things like, you know, there's no clean water on the reserves and all kinds of these things that I have very little understanding of why. I think many other people are in the same position. Okay. And so I'm wondering if we can spend some time and really talk about what the problems are. That might be even as broad of a question as what is reconciliation. Maybe we can narrow this down to, you know, I don't know, a handful or less. But what do you think the main problems that, what are the main problems we're currently dealing with or that Indigenous communities are currently dealing with? You mentioned one in the form of wealth transfer, which I think is, at least from my perspective, that sounds like one of the more serious ones, but I'll let you answer that.
So, I've got an example of something that, like, I think deep down, it really frustrates me. So, in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and our Grand Council, a lot of our agreements contracts. I'm going to speak a little bit into corporate world. This is the two-eyed part coming out. So agreements and contracts were formed using wampum. Okay? So let's say like a settler, wampum is just strands of beads made from quahog shells. They're usually purple and white. And the patterns in the beads create an agreement and an understanding that's made between parties or nations or people. Okay? And so let's say like settlers would come and say, we're going to give this community this much money for this land and we're going to take it for the crown or whatever. And here's the contract. But then our community would say, we can't read that contract. We don't know what you're asking us to sign. We don't even know what that is. But if you're talking about an agreement on how to move forward together, here's this wampum belt and here's what it represents. So it's like in indigenous law, this would be like a contract. Okay. And from the banking perspective, if I were to write a deal structure, we would have a loan agreement in there, and we would also have potentially some covenants, you know, and if you're in violation of those covenants, then that's a big problem. If you're in violation of the loan agreement, you're going to end up in special loans, you're going to end up in the legal system, and you know what I mean? Like, these things can evolve into things that neither party wants, right? But they must be adhered to because that is what we agree to. So the Gushwenta, or the two-row wampum belt, that was made 400 years ago in this kind of Haudenosaunee territory, so in Ontario, with the first settlers, one of the first groups of settlers that arrived, the Dutch. And the Dutch came and said, we will move forward together. We're going to stay a while, right? Our families are arriving. We're going to stay. And we're going to be the father and you're going to be the son. And they said that to our Haudenosaunee leadership. And our Haudenosaunee leadership said, that would mean that you do not view us as equals, that you view us as a father figure, so you're going to direct us. So no. Here's this wampum belt. And that's a whole other lesson. It's actually a 7-day story of this wampum belt. But the essence of that wampum belt, okay, would be that both sides will flow down the river of life together in their respective vessels and never interfere with each other's ways. That will flow down the river of life together and support one another as allies and as equals, as siblings. And the other element of that agreement is that both sides agree that the number one priority, aside from not interfering in each other's ways, is to protect water. Is to protect the water. And so a problem is that our community and me personally, I view that agreement was made with no end date, in perpetuity. So that agreement to me exists today. And that means that all settlers that arrive here should be here. I mean, in the territory with which that agreement was made. All settlers that occupy, all new arrivals and newcomers and need to understand what that contract, what that agreement means. And it's just frustrating that we're living in violation of that contract every single day. And corporations and even some individuals don't view the responsibility to protect water in the same way that that agreement was made. And they don't necessarily view the agreement around interfering or historically interfering with people's ways of living, right? And so that is just one example, but there's so many of these agreements and treaties that exist that are constantly in violation. And so how do we start with reconciliation when we're still violating those original agreements? And it's like, let's build trust. We want to start a relationship in a good way, and we want to build trust, and we want to work with you as an Indigenous community in reconciliation in this spirit. And our community is going, we still have an agreement that's currently being violated today.
Yeah.
And you want us to write a new contract with you about how to do business in a corporate way, in your way? And I think that's a huge problem that needs to be addressed. This conflict between tort law and case law in the Canadian judicial system and Indigenous law that our nations have laws and legal structures and governance structures in place already that still exist, that still function well, and those aren't respected and honored or viewed in the same way.
Michael, I wanted to ask you a question that just plays on that feedback, because you had mentioned, you know, what's gotten in the way, what's preventing communities from thriving in Indigenous communities. My question is about consent. As you've said, you know, when we look back in our history in Canada, past governments, we didn't honor the original agreements with Indigenous communities when it comes to things like land rights and things like protecting culture. Yet today we know that, for example, 56% of an estimated $60 billion in critical minerals projects involve Indigenous territory. And, you know, we also have renewables developments for wind and solar energy. This also overlaps with Indigenous lands. So, you know, we chatted a little bit about economic prosperity and economic reconciliation, and now about what's getting in the way. I guess when it comes back, when it comes to aspects of gaining consent with Indigenous communities in 2022, how do we achieve that when we've not acted in good faith in the past?
You answer that one perfectly, Michael. I think we're going to solve a lot of problems today.
Yeah, right. So consent, and I would take it one step further, and I would say, like, continuous consent is important. So not just at the initial phase of an agreement or a project, but how does that continue over time? You know, probably a bigger question. I'm just kind of asking myself right now, but consent is challenging because it requires unique understandings of each community, and each community, you know, in Canada, there's over 650 different First Nation communities, each with unique customs, traditions, values, ceremony, language. And they're on unique geographies with unique geographic opportunities and unique governance structures in particular. So oftentimes, consent is considered granted from a colonial lens when the colonial governance system agrees. So, for example, the chief and council system was created, and governments say, in order to do deals or receive consent from a community, we need to get consent from the chief and council. That's the elected chief and council. In a community, realistically, even chief and council would say, and I know this because I've sat in many decision-making meetings in boardrooms with chief and council, there would come a point where they would say, does everyone believe that the community would support this? Because if not, this is stopping here. So community consultation goes beyond chief and council. And in the corporate world, if you were to have a conversation with any, you know, executive leadership, what they would always refer to if you ask them if they have a relationship with the community or if they have consent is, yeah, we spoke to the chief. But in many of our communities, the women lead and the grandmothers lead, and the grandmothers could stop a project in its tracks and also send the chief and council packing. So we're not talking to the women in the communities. We're not talking to the other leaders and the elders in the communities. We're saying, we're going to go to the chief and council because our law says that they're the ones that we need to go to. And as you can observe across the country, that doesn't always work as it relates to trying to create consent for partnerships and joint ventures. There's always seems to be a colonial approach to the way to engage in a relationship, which is, let's show up, let's tell them the box we operate in, tell them to fit inside that, get this approval from chief and council by trying to offer some sort of monetary consideration or compensation. And usually those also involve some kind of convoluted legal language, which is not in many cases fully understood. So I think for consent, you need to go for more than a day. I would say, just as an example, like if I was a mining company, because we referenced mining there, and you know the transition to this electric revolution is going to require huge earth moving projects and mineral projects, and Canada has a lot of land and resources in this way. So if I were to say a mining company, I would go to a community with a team of experts, and I would sit in the community for a month. And I would sit and I would listen to everyone. I would meet the grandmothers. I would listen to the knowledge keepers about how they talk about the characteristics of the land, what they've seen and what they've seen happen over the last 4,000 years with the land. What happens when we move land to other land downstream in other communities? I would talk about the project that we want to do, and I would ask for their engineering expertise on how to co-design and co-create the project. I would ensure that community safety and wellness was at the forefront, and you know, instead of setting up, let's say, like sometimes these large infrastructure projects set up these things, they're in the community they refer to them as man camps. But usually it's in a remote area and it's a bunch of trailers and there's like 100, 150 men that just get situated to do 12-hour shifts of work. And what we know is that that's not healthy for our spirit. You know, a bunch of men together is not healthy. There's a direct correlation with those camps and violence against women in communities. And so I would sit and I would try to understand every element in a circular way of what exactly the development is going to do, seven generation principles. So companies tend to think like long term is 10 years or 25 years. Our communities think seven generations, which is around 560 years. So a lot harder to plan for that, a lot more responsibility on decision makers to try to think about how many generations are impacted by the start of a project. And I would think about doing things in a different way. And usually that's just a result of spending a lot more time and a lot more time on the design and the decision. And I would ask the communities, how do they make decisions? What are the decision filters and the decision matrices and the tools that they use in their governance to come to make good decisions? And how can our company or our organization, be influenced or inspired by some of those things to help us make better decisions on a project, or how to so you're embedding principles in the core culture and the DNA of your company. And if you're a mining company or some other organization that wants to do this or partner with indigenous communities, this is the way that you need to be thinking, right? And very small percentage of organizations and leadership is thinking like this.
You know, what's funny, Michael, is, I don't know if it's funny, but maybe ironic, I don't know. I was just going to ask you if we could spend some time talking about, you know, I was going to word it like, you know, what have we tried so far and how has it gone wrong? And then I was going to say, you know, what can we do? But what's kind of funny about that is me even asking that question kind of feels like, as you put it, a colonial approach to engaging the relationship. Because it implies that, you know, there's something that we, as a, you know, non-Indigenous portion of Canada, there's something that we have to do instead of perhaps some more collaborative approach. So I guess that has my mind going to what's actually the goal here. Like when I think about, you know, the youth and not just the youth of, you know, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, but, you know, I try to think of like one value that seems to be really important in Canada and certainly is important to me would be something like equal opportunity, right? And I like to think that that's a goal for, or at least an end goal for many people in many different scenarios. But is that a goal here? I guess what I'm saying is, what are the goals that we're really thriving towards with all these issues that we're bringing up?
So equal opportunity, yes. I'm sensitive about equality, because I've seen that emerge and create situations where people who are allies trying to help focus on equality. And sometimes what happens with equality is then they say, well, if we do this thing for Indigenous communities, we must do this for all communities. And that doesn't capture or recognize the uniqueness and the unique legal considerations that exist for Indigenous communities in Canada, because there are unique legal frameworks that exist, and they would suggest that there are unique opportunities. And I would say, again, trying to think more of it from a perspective of equity. So how do we achieve equitable opportunities? And that would mean actually some form of indemnification or compensation. And we see this now happening through the government with some land claims and land settlements that are happening in communities to try to indemnify communities for some of the losses that realistically communities weren't, like, much like my grandfather, not allowed to participate in the economy, yet the land and the resources were used to generate tremendous amounts of wealth for lots of people and organizations. Meanwhile, our communities were suffering without water or education or healthcare. And so, you know, that is something that, an example of that is I was just at a Canadian Council of Aboriginal Business Economic Forum that was held here in Mi'kma'ki. And Hydro-Québec was there talking about a joint venture that they did with some Mohawks in Ganawagi for a transmission line. And the Mohawk community reached out to Québec Power and said, we want to help you with this. And, you know, we will open up our territory to allow you to move this transmission line through to provide clean energy to New York, right? And Hydro-Québec said everything about that deal, the representative that they had there said everything about that deal was great, except that the Mohawk community brought no capital to the project, but wanted 50-50 equity stake in the power purchase agreement or the sharing that was going to happen as a result of the revenue streams. And they said, you know, it was really hard to negotiate that, and we didn't like that. So when we do deals in the future, we'd like Indigenous communities to bring the amount of capital that equates to the percentage of ownership. And so that's just an example of a conflict that exists. Now, that project moved forward and it's successful and it's doing what it's supposed to do. But this concept of, well, we want the Indigenous community to bring money to this deal, which seems logical, right? But if you've been excluded from generating money or capital for the entire history of your community, getting access to capital is a little trickier than, maybe mezzanine debt or go into some senior debt market. And so I viewed it, and I viewed what Hydro-Québec did there as a real reflection of what reconciliation looks like, because they used their capital, 100% of the capital to fund that project from Hydro-Québec, and they gave 50-50 ownership to that community. So they gave up. They paid to have that partner. And I think that's a pretty good model of the way that the way that companies should view these type of projects, is that, not every Indigenous community is going to have $100 million of capital to inject into a major infrastructure project. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't partner with them. And that doesn't mean that if you, if you have the financial means, and if you've benefited for 150 years or more from the resources and land that was shared with you, then I think it's time that you consider what it's like to give some of that back, some of that prosperity back.
Michael, I wanted to ask you some questions about this report that was released by RBC Economics, the 92-0 report, and it talks about sustainability, the road to net zero, and how this is linked with the importance of partnership with Indigenous peoples in this country. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Everyone in Canada, you're Indigenous or not, we all have a vested interest in building a more sustainable planet and combating climate change. What do you think is important to understand about the role of Indigenous leadership in this area? And you just highlighted a really good example about Hydro-Québec. But could you give me maybe some other examples of what partnership with Indigenous communities could look like to advance our collective interest when it comes to climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I get into that one, though, I am curious, because the first part of that question, I think it kind of talked a little about, like, what it means to be Canadian or something like that. And I'm curious from both of you, like, when you think of yourself as Canadians, like, what are those elements of your identity that you think of when you try to close your eyes and think about what it means to be Canadian?
I don't know about you, Jeff. I mean, for me, I think about freedom. I think about how we live in a free and open society to express what it is we want to express without fear of being condemned in some way. I think of how lucky we are to live in a country that where there's so many opportunities for education, the opportunity to earn wealth, the opportunity to pursue different career interests, to travel this country, to participate in cultural events, hockey, Tim Hortons, all that stuff, bacon. I mean, I don't know, the list goes on, but in essence, I'm proud to be Canadian.
Yeah, and great question, Michael, but like, you know, the words that came to my mind, I had freedom certainly is on the list, no question. Let's say like freedom, multiculturalism, honesty, and perhaps fairness were the things that came up. And to me, that represents, I think that at least an initial reaction to what it feels like to me to be a good Canadian, or to be, you know, those are the acts, let me try it again. Those are the aspects of Canadian society I'm most proud of.
Yeah. And I think that's, if I were to like extrapolate a lot of the answers when I ask others those questions, there's a lot of alignment there. What about like culture? You know, I know you said multicultural, but in terms of like on the global scale, Canada is 150 years old. So, you know, you ask someone from Europe or you ask someone from China, you know, what it means to be from the area or the land that they're from and culturally, and they'll tell you a whole bunch of things that are can be traced back in some cases to like a lot of like ancient knowledge and tradition. And so I'm curious about that piece of your Canadian identity or how you see it, or what is Canadian culture?
Oh, I don't know. And I think I specifically said multiculturalism because everyone's coming at this from a different perspective. I grew up in a small Acadian village. And that's going to be a very different experience from someone who grew up in downtown Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I suspect our cultures would be vastly different. The culture that I grew up in was entwined with, a French Acadian community, largely Catholic, which was certainly a part of the, sense of community that I grew up with. But I'm not sure. I would probably have to give some more thought to really answer that question. You know, what is Canadian culture? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I'm the product of a Frenchman from Normandy, France, and a woman from northeastern Germany, and I'm a first-generation Canadian. So, for me and for my children, you know, I certainly grew up. You know, English is my third language. People look at me and they think I'm a white guy with no accent. Automatically assume I grew up here my whole life, and I'm first generation. So I think I represent like what a lot of people are across this country. It's like we have parents from elsewhere. They've come to settle here for many different reasons. A lot of the things Jeff and I talked about earlier, the freedom, the opportunity, the harmony amongst our people. But it's still important for us to share. Like my children speak French and German. I'm proud of that fact. And I want that to continue so they can connect with older generations and maybe pass that on to their kids. And that's part of what being Canadian means to me. It's like, you don't have to, the culture is informed by your upbringing and your past, but you make it what it is for next generations and make them work globally minded, conscientious, educated, empathetic people. And that's the culture I can get behind. And it doesn't matter what language you speak or who raised you or where they're from. We're in Canada. Those are values that we mutually respect and appreciate, and to, as we move forward, and that needs to be learned and taught, and it's important to me.
Mm-hmm. This is my final question for you guys.
yeah, who's interviewing you here, Michael?
Well, just on that, so just related to that, you know, would either of you disagree that there's an element of Canadian culture or what it means to be Canadian that is inherently Indigenous, that if we think about other ancient cultures and things that are thousands of years old, recognizing that people were here and things existed before the formalities which created Canada. So the culture here, like I have a mentor through this, it's called RIME, RBC's Indigenous Mentorship Experience. It's a reciprocal mentorship, and sometimes you're matched with non-Indigenous mentors, and Indigenous mentor matched with a non-Indigenous mentor. And fascinating matchup I had. He's a guy who works on our quantum computing desk. So, brilliant mind. He's a physicist on the side. And he said, I feel no connection to Canadian culture, but by the nature of my proximity to the land, I default to Indigenous culture as a way, as a compass for me to identify with something that has more substance than the you know, infancy of Canadian culture. Because 100 years on the scale of culture, 100 years isn't a long time, 150 years. So, you know, here's this non-Indigenous guy saying that his curiosity, why he joined this program, and what he studies as part of history, and why he was, everything he asked me is trying to understand Indigenous culture, because he views that as who he is as a Canadian. Even though he does not identify as an Indigenous person, he has zero blood quantum. I think he was German as well, right? So, that is something that I'd love people that listen to this to really think about and try to reflect on when we think about who we are. And a great example of a place to look to for what this could look like, or something like an optimistic vision that I see, would be to look at New Zealand and how New Zealand and non-Indigenous Kiwis have adopted the culture of the Maori as a piece of their identity, how they practice the haka in elementary school and grade school. They practice the ceremonies at their weddings, and they view a connectedness and a unity in the cultures, even though they don't identify as, and they view it as a piece of who they are. And I think that's an opportunity for us here in Canada as we look towards reconciliation and a way to model ourselves. Now, there's a second part of that question, Marcel, which you asked about. I think it was more around economic reconciliation or
the importance of Indigenous leadership when it comes to partnership with communities, when it comes to advancing our national interest in climate change and climate change.
Yeah. So more and more what I'm seeing in the corporate landscape is that organizations are evolving their core values and their cultures, and the evolution and the direction that those values are heading are in alignment with Indigenous culture and community values. And I don't even think companies realize it, right? But like, just examples like women in leadership, ESG, right? Social governance and environment, even the climate conversation and trying to build sustainable companies and thinking about carbon and climate and actively thinking about these things. And I believe in the past, these considerations weren't weighted as heavily as they needed to be. And our communities were always screaming these things from the mountaintop: sustainability, harmony, long-term thinking. And so, again, I'm going to go back to the community that I'm from. So if you were to look at Six Nations of the Grand River and you were to pull that up on Google Maps, and you were to look at it from a satellite view, and you start to zoom in on that area on a map would be the area of Southwest Ontario that is much more luscious, dark, deep green. And that area sits in what's referred to as the Carolinian Zone. It's a unique area of Canada and the world, which has a great climate for specific species. That's one of the last areas in my community of old growth forest. It represents a significant amount of biodiversity, more than many other areas in Canada. That reserve community is also one of the most economically developed of any Indigenous First Nation community across the country. And so what I'm trying to get at is the leadership in that area deliberately made decisions. In some cases, in the short-term timeline, might not have seemed like the best economic decision for the community, right? Maybe it required too many criteria to support a project, yet it still was able to achieve economic prosperity, at the same time finding harmony and balance to be able to maintain one of the most biodiverse areas in Canada, to maintain old growth forests, and to preserve an area of land that now, if you were to zoom out from Six Nations on the map and look at everything else around it, you would see a lot of agriculture and gray space, which is, you know, where the development of cities and things have occurred. And so all I'm trying to highlight there is that Indigenous leadership as it relates to economic development and the decisions that the way that our communities come to make decisions has the potential to create a scenario where we can have balance between a healthy environment, which means a healthy community, healthy life, healthy body, healthy plants, healthy animals, healthy soil, healthy air, healthy water, just like the original agreements that were made to both sides and all people that arrive here to protect the water, because water is life, and without that, there is no business, there is no prosperity, and there are no communities. And so you have the ability to try to achieve less of a parasitic approach to economic development and more of a symbiotic relationship with business and the environment. And I think that is the value that Indigenous leadership brings to the direction that businesses are heading in trying to achieve some of their climate and sustainability goals.
You shared with me just prior to hitting record on this podcast that you're about to go on a retreat with some elders to study about the lands and some of the teachings that you're about to embark on from these elders. Can you just expand on what this is and what you hope to take away from it when it comes to the treatment of the lands and your knowledge of it?
Yep, and I'll expand on the why and why I'm doing this. So the equivalent of like the policy handbook or the equivalent of the Bible or something, I don't know, but it's not religious, is in my community called Guyana Rancoa. And that's like the great peace that guides us. And our people are referred to as Onkwe Honwe. Onkwe Honwe. Onkwe is the people, Honwe is that follow the path of forever, to follow the path of creation. And the lessons and the principles that are guided in Guyana Rancoa, basically summarizing another 2 week long story, but in summary, it teaches us that we need to look to creation always. That looking to creation will give us a lot of answers to a lot of the problems we're trying to solve. And when we start to think from an individualistic nature or from a hierarchical perspective where we put humans at the top of the pyramid, that is when we start to fail. Our communities got lost when we stopped listening to the women. When the women speak, it's as if the earth speaks. Should never do anything to the land without women. And when we lost our way and war started and people were suffering, we stopped listening to the women. When the peacekeeper came, he asked that the women go into the woods and come back when they feel the time is right, and to go and look at the animals and to bring back the lessons for our community to show us on how to live with each other, with the animals, with the rest of creation. And that's how we got our clan systems. The woman came back and said, we saw the bear, and the bear did this. The bear took care of the cub, and this is what. And when the bear, went to the bathroom, the seeds came out, and new plants grew. And then we looked at the muskrat, and we looked at the eagle, and what are the lessons that they teach us on how to exist better with one another? And so here in Mi'kma'ki, Ulnawig, an amazing organization, through their foundation, has acquired Windhorse Farms, Windhorse Farms was fascinating to me because I just shared that story about Six Nations and 1% biodiversity and the last old growth forest. Windhorse Farms is one of the last old growth forests here in Mi'kma'ki. And when Ulnawik acquired Windhorse Farms, they incorporated into their wellness retreats Mi'kmaq elders and land-based learning to teach about traditional medicines and harvesting and the relationship with the land. And so it's really important for me because I follow Guyana Rancoa, but I'm here in Mi'kma'ki and I want to learn about the land here and I want to learn from creation here. Because the more I learn about that, the more I become a better person in my relationship with my wife, with my clients, and it helps me to evolve and develop better principles to guide me. And I would say my recommendation would be to anyone listening as well, especially other leaders, that if you're going to do, there's something that we do that's called like, a principle that I have is this. Never say words if you can't live in alignment with them. And I'm not going to talk about environmental stewardship. I'm on RBC's climate working group. I don't want to do climate work and sustainability if I don't live and have a relationship with the land. Nor do I think anyone else is qualified to do that. So if you're going to design an environmental policy, then you need to have a relationship with the land and be able to articulate that, because that's how you're going to understand it. And you're going to learn from the land about how to do the work better. So these opportunities for me and why I'm doing this at Windhorse Farms, which is it's a 4-day retreat, full 4 days. You leave your technology at home. You're not allowed to bring it. It's called Less Screen, More Green is the kind of title in English. And to spend time with elders in nature, in ceremony, learning, in the hopes that that will help me as a leader make better decisions and guide me as I get into more climate and sustainability work and on advancing a lot of the stuff in the corporate space in economic reconciliation.
So I'm wondering if we can tie this, and we've had you for some time already, but maybe we can end on a question I wanted to make sure we discussed, or an item I wanted to make sure we discussed. So what can employers do or you know, institutions more broadly, and maybe we can bring in, you know, what the Royal Eagles are and exactly what you're doing there?
Yeah. So organizations have to start somewhere. Different organizations and different sizes and scales are at different level of this journey. The important thing to understand is it's a long journey. And if you adapt an indigenous principle, again, going back to 7 generations, this is a long-term strategy. Sometimes this is tricky for organizations to try to adapt and understand indigenous perspectives in the things that they're doing, because so many of what we do in the corporate world is rooted in performance-based metrics and quick things and what did we do year over year and what was the success rate and how many people participated, and it's all of these things that are driven by a performance culture, and it lacks the long-term strategic vision, the long-term thinking, which really enables initiatives and activations and programs to evolve and develop. I would say a concept that I think is really important for indigenous companies to understand for bigger, larger corporations to understand is that you may be too big to do a lot of what you're trying to do in a meaningful way inside the structure as it exists today. So, it's a debate that's happening right now in some communities is like, is it possible to indigenize colonial dysfunction? Right? And so do we make incremental improvements to the existing, or do we just start something net new and try to build a new structure? And a lot of times, like, you know, a recommendation I would put to a company, like if they're talking about valuing indigenous knowledge and valuing equity ownership in things, then I would say, why don't you create a joint venture that's completely indigenous owned, led, managed, run, and you're a partner in it and support that instead of trying to make your company indigenous, which might take 150 years to try to do it. And by that time, you won't make the progress on the specific things that you're trying to do. It's like, why don't we just create something new and let indigenous people do it 100%? as far as the Royal Eagles is our indigenous community at RBC. 780 indigenous community members last time I checked. That ebbs and flows with our associates and interns and all of our programming that happens across the country. We've got about 200 highly active, engaged members that are really connected. We have a lot of unique characteristics that no other organization can say they have as it relates to their indigenous communities. In fact, most companies don't even know who their indigenous people are in the organization, with the exception of maybe someone in HR who kind of vets the boxes that get ticked, but they wouldn't be able to name names and call people to the table. We have a line of sight. I speak to 200 indigenous people weekly across the organization because we have a community group chat. And the cool thing about the Royal Eagles and the thing that I'm most proud of with reconciliation and the stuff that we're doing at RBC really is this community and the organization's support to enable us to embed indigenous principles into the way that we operate. So, for example, if you were to look at other employee resource groups, right, and we have many, they are governed with more of a hierarchical corporate structure in their leadership models and their governance models. The Royal Eagles is governed in a more traditional way. We have an elder council, women's council, we're building a youth council, and we go through a consensus model, which really kind of mimics like something that we would call like a council fire situation, where we operate more in a circular way than in a pyramid hierarchical way. And we make decisions based on consensus. Our leadership isn't picked by other non-Indigenous leaders. Our leadership is picked from within. Our leadership at its core is Indigenous. It always has a balance of masculine, feminine energy in the regional chapters. And you'd be hard-pressed to find something that happens in our organization that hasn't involved some form of counsel or consultation with our Royal Eagles and Indigenous community members. And so that's why I would say we are doing some things that have never been done, and I think that's what differentiates us, and I think that's why we're winning, and I think that's why a lot of our programs and initiatives are really successful right now, because they're being co-created. In the past, similar to the external environment, in the past what would happen was we would get brought in at the last phase of something to give it a final review. And what's happening today is we're being brought in at the idea stage all the way through to design, execution, and implementation. And then along the way, as things continue to iterate and evolve in that agile way. So truly a unique thing, something I'm proud of. When I post on LinkedIn something about Royal Eagles, people who are no longer with RBC, who are like, you know, 10 years removed, make comments. I was a Royal Eagle. I remember what it was like. What a community. And it's, it's something special.
Maybe we can end it there. Something special. You give us some hope for the future here. It seems obvious to me when we had this discussion that this could go on for probably many other podcasts. Okay. I think we've tackled a lot of the beginning, stuff I wanted to go through here, and I'm really looking forward to people hearing this conversation.
Thank you, Michael.
Niawen, best thank you in Mohawk.
This audio file is provided by RBC Wealth Management for informational purposes only. In Canada, RBC Wealth Management is the brand name that refers to RBC Dominion Securities, Inc. and applicable affiliates. In the United States, RBC Wealth Management is a division of RBC Capital Markets, LLC. In the United Kingdom and Channel Islands, RBC's Wealth Management International Division in these jurisdictions is comprised of an international network of RBC companies and includes RBC Europe Limited and RBC Investment Solutions CI Limited. In Asia, RBC Wealth Management is the global brand name to describe the wealth management business of the Royal Bank of Canada and its affiliates and branches, including Royal Bank of Canada Singapore Branch, Royal Bank of Canada Hong Kong Branch, and RBC Investment Services Asia Limited. The comments contained in this audio file are general in nature, do not have regard to the particular circumstances or needs of any specific person, and do not constitute legal, investment, trust, estate, accounting, or tax advice. They are based on information believed to be accurate and complete, but we cannot guarantee its accuracy or completeness. Unless otherwise qualified, any opinions, estimates, and projections in this audio file are those of the speakers as of the release date, are subject to change without notice, and may not reflect those of RBC Wealth Management. This audio file may not reflect all available information. The investments or services contained in this audio file may not be suitable for you, and it is recommended you consult with your investment advisor if you are in doubt about the suitability of such investments or services. In Canada, to obtain additional disclaimers concerning this audio file, please speak with your investment advisor.